Longtime Paonia resident and former publisher of High Country News, Ed Marston, passed away last week. KVNF celebrates and honors this beloved community member and local journalist by featuring an interview with Ed, where he shares stories about starting the North Fork Times, acquiring High Country News and moving it to Paonia, current politics, and covering the rural West for more than 30 years. The interview was conducted by reporter Abigail Sensky for KVNF in February of 2018 and is part of a bigger series about High Country News. Marston was a physicist before he became an environmental journalist and political organizer. He died on August 31st of complications from West Nile virus. He was 78 years old. He survived by his wife and working partner, Betsy Marston. Ed and Betsy came to Paonia from New York City in the early 70s. Here, Ed describes their first trip to the North Fork Valley.
We lived in New York on the East Coast, and I had a friend, a fellow graduate student, who would come out west, and we thought we'd come out and visit him. And we did, and we were gobsmacked, I think that's the phrase. We'd never been in America before. And here we are, all this land, ours, federal, and all these little towns and all these very nice people. We started coming back, and we had a cabin built. And then we'd come out every summer for years.
And what year was it that you guys decided to make the move from New York?
So we decided to take a year off in 1974 to come out to first to our cabin and then live in Paonia for a year, 74, 75.
And what were your intentions in that year? Obviously, things changed. You didn't go back to New York.
Yeah, we didn't have any intentions. We were just getting away from our lives.
When you stayed on, what motivated you guys to start North Fork Times?
Well, that wasn't how it worked. So we're here. We moved to town in middle of September. And we get really bored within a few weeks. We were irritated by the local paper, which was very hateful. And he had a big hippie stay out sign on his door. And he would publish nasty things about so-called hippies. And we thought, well, why don't we do a newspaper? We'd met on our college newspaper. And so we went to the bank, and they loaned us $4,000 to start a paper. And we did. And we thought, well, we started it January 9th, I think, 1975, and we figured by May or June it would have failed, and we would go back to our lives. And our real lives, as opposed to our Paonia lives. And instead, the paper took off. And within weeks, we had the largest circulation paper in the North Fork Valley. We were competing against two or three other papers. We ran North Fork Times for 6 years, and then we sold it. And we thought, you know, thinking ever larger, we'd cover the Western Slope, which was then going through an oil shale energy boom. And so we started circulating this regional paper reporting on oil shale and other things throughout Western Colorado. And it didn't take off the way North Fork Times had. It did okay. Then after running it for a year or so, we heard that High Country News was up for grabs. The people who were running High Country News, a regional environmental paper then based in Lander, Wyoming, didn't want to keep doing it, and they were looking for someone to take it over. And so we said we would take it over if they'd move it to Paonia. And they did.
And you said when you guys took over, you and Betsy served as kind of new immigrants to a different country who provided a totally different lens of coverage to High Country.
Well, that was more true of North Fork Times. I mean, the reason our paper succeeded against these local papers that are reflected the community much, were run by people who were much more part of the community than two New Yorkers. I mean, I used to be a college professor and Betsy was a TV producer and on-air host. Was that we did, you know, we were so interested in this place. We'd never encountered people who raised their own food or rode horses or dug coal from underground and did amazing things and could fix everything themselves. I mean, I grew up in an apartment. And so I think our interest conveyed itself in the paper pages of the paper. We were enthusiastic. I mean, we'd meet someone whose parents had come here in covered wagons, if you can imagine. And so, and it was still, you know, it was America as we had read about it in our silly textbooks. And so we were just fascinated. And I think that fascination and enthusiasm and outrage, too, at how silly things were. I mean, like the Paonia Town Council. So they met at 7, but at 6 they'd get together and rehearse, which even then was in violation of the open records law. But they didn't, you know, they weren't comfortable performing in public. So when Betsy covered, I think it was Hotchkiss, one of the councilmen looked at her and said, "Are you writing down what I say?" You know, and this was Watergate summer. So we were Woodward and Bernstein. There was a whole energy going through about being a journalist. You know, it was amazing. You can come here and borrow a few thousand dollars from a bank and set up a newspaper, and suddenly you've got the bullhorn. And people react to you.
Was there a feeling that you guys were outsiders?
Yeah. We used to joke. People loved the paper. You know, the local people, the hippies like ourselves, so-called hippies like ourselves, you know, they wasn't that interesting to them, I don't think. But we used to joke they wanted to think of it as being immaculately conceived. They didn't want to associate a couple of obvious New Yorkers. Someone said of Betsy that she walked down Grand Avenue like she was on Fifth Avenue or something. You know, just...
And how long did that feeling of you guys as outsiders last?
Let's see. We've been here 42 years.
And you still feel like outsiders?
Well, I don't know if No, because the community's changed around us. I mean, when we got here, we were unique. I mean, there were lots of urban people, but they wanted to go back to the land and smoke dope and, you know, they can't, and maybe take a couple of years off or a decade off. But we were in our mid-30s. We had two little children. We were professionals. And so we just wanted to go to work, which was not what our cohort wanted to do.
When you guys officially took over High Country and it came here in the pickup truck, could you tell me a little bit about what your vision for the paper was?
Well, we merged it into Western Colorado Report. We had about 800 Western Colorado Report subscribers. High Country News had 3,300 subscribers. And our vision was to cover the West, the rural West, as if it were a small town, because that's what we knew how to do. We'd spent 6 years covering, you know, this end of Delta County as a small town. So here was just another small town, except this small town was a million square miles. It was 10 what I call big box states, you know, Walmart kind of states. They're each about 100,000 square miles. There are 10 of them. So that's a million square miles. And then half of that is federal, Forest Service and BLM, you know, and a smattering of parks. So we took as our beat the 500,000 square miles of federal land, because you couldn't possibly cover the 10 states and the hundreds or thousands of small towns, but you could cover the federal estate. And so we learned about the BLM and the Forest Service and the Park Service and so on. And so that provided unity. And then the different forests and national parks and BLM areas and national monuments and so on were the stuff on which we reported. And we reported it as if there were no state boundaries. And we came to focus on, or I came to focus on, public land ranching. So as I say, 500,000 square miles of federal land, something like 80% of that was grazed under permit by ranchers. something like 20,000 ranchers. And they were the interesting people to me. The loggers and miners were part of an industrial machine. They had no autonomy. They were run by large corporations. they were just pieces of the machine. But the ranchers owned their own property. And in theory, at least, they could, you could expect interesting things from some of them. Because they weren't being headed by, you know, a corporation that had to pay attention to its bottom line.
And the ranchers were part of this editorial framework that you had about Western coalitions. Could you explain a little bit?
Well, I thought it was tragic that environmentalists decided that ranchers were the enemy, that, you know, the cattle were really hoofed locusts, and that the goal of life in the West was to become cattle-free by, kept receding, of course, 83, 93, 2003. And because I thought that the ranchers were the rooted communitarian part of the West. And yeah, the cattle weren't managed well. There was a lot of damage that had been done and continued to be done. But that was a problem to be dealt with, not a problem to be abolished. And so at the time, part of the time we ran High Country News, a former Arizona governor named Bruce Babbitt, who also ran for president, was Secretary of Interior. And he was really open to that and began commuting to Denver once a week to meet with a coalition of ranchers to, you know, it was like North Korea and South Korea meeting to see if they could work out an understanding. And meanwhile, there were efforts on the ground, so-called collaborative groups, consisted of sellout environmentalists, in the words of the Sierra Club or an Edward Abbey, and who would work with ranchers and work with the agencies and try to figure out how to manage a piece of ground, because it was all about managing a piece of ground, wherever that ground was. I mean, and taking all the cattle off, I mean, you could see in, you know, in Yellowstone, where the elk devastated Yellowstone. So getting rid of the cattle would have just created another set of problems.
When you look back on your tenure as publisher, do you think you stayed true to that vision of covering the West?
It evolved. I came to see the Forest Service as a hapless organization. Now, what is it? It's just a fire department. Because of the way the forests were logged and beetle killed and because of climate change, I mean, a bunch of things happened. But the Forest Service that I knew was not the Forest Service that took command in the turn of the last century of these lands and exercised control. It was basically an adjunct of logging. And so that vision emerged, and I saw how pathetic the leadership of the Gunnison National Forest was, the forest that's all around us. And so you couldn't help but extrapolate from your local experience in part, but we tried not to be too Peonia-centric or even Western Colorado-centric, because the West is huge. I ran High Country News from 83 till I quit in 02. And somewhere around mid-90s, I realized I had lost my vision. And I metaphorically would talk about going blind, that I couldn't see. The West changed. What happened was there was an economic land boom. Resorts became the driver of the West. Resorts, rich people who wanted to be, thought they wanted to be ranchers or at least wanted to own ranches. Real estate developers drove the West. Prairie castles, you know, the whole excess, what seemed to me an excess. And I realized that if I were starting afresh with High Country News, I would cover real estate and not cattle logging, ranching, water development, because real estate development at that period drove the West. I'd like to think I'm a journalist, not an ideologue. And if the story shifted in the West to real estate, then I would shift to real estate.
And was there a moment when you realized that you had lost that vision?
I don't know if there was a moment. I know we took a sabbatical and taught at, first I was a fellow at Stanford in 1991, and then at Berkeley. And I think it really hit me at Berkeley in about the year 2000. I mean, it had been creeping up. Because at that point, I didn't know real estate. I couldn't cover that beat. It was too late. The world had changed. It's like Paonia. You know, the world has changed here. We had 1,000 coal mining jobs. Now we got 200. The agricultural base is different. But the people who have been coal miners for generations, the people who have done a certain kind of row crop agriculture for generations, they can't get let go. So they just get mad. And I don't remember if I got mad over the fact that life had taken this funny turn, but yet at the same time, I didn't know how to do anything else. I'm now getting into my 60s, so I'm sort of stuck. The paper's stuck. It took a, you know, cancer to get me off the dime.
You spoke to this a little bit earlier, but how did you become credible with the legions of people who were thinking about the West and writing about the West and shaping the narrative of the West? When Charles Wilkinson was writing one of his books, he said he wanted to talk to two people and that you were one of them. How did you get on Charles Wilkinson's list of two people to talk to?
I don't know. It's like asking an opera singer how she hits the high notes. I mean, I would see things and I would write them. And then I won't say I would do it in a trance, but it just seemed very clear to me. And I was amazed that everyone couldn't see it or that they thought it was interesting that I could see it. And that's why I say sometime in the mid-90s, where once I lost that vision, I couldn't do the paper anymore, even though I kept doing it. Because that's all you have. All you have is your vision and your sense of how the place works and where it might be going.
This kind of narrative about true Westerners and, you know, is Paonia.
Paonia has become suburban. It is no longer rural. Now, Hotchkiss, if you go to Hotchkiss or you go to Delta, it's still rural. But we're not rural anymore.
And what makes that difference?
Well, the people who live here, the institutions like KVNF, the sophisticated radio station, Blue Sage across the street, the elsewhere attracting artists from around the world, someone from China there now. Last week it was someone from Iceland or Finland, I can't remember. It's very cosmopolitan. When Solar Energy International goes into gear in a couple of months, there'll be students who come from all over the world. They come, because I used to be president of its board, I would talk to them every Monday. There were people from countries I didn't know existed. So this is not rural, the rural West. And last year, Betsy and I drove up to Montana to the Crow Fair. And, you know, then I was in the West. It just feels different. You drive for hours and you'll see three or four cars, even on a pretty good highway.
Now everybody's obsessed, it seems like, in the media world after the 2016 election with rural places and Western places and places that were part of the Trump electorate. And they're kind of grasping at straws, it seems like, to tell stories and figure out why this happened, why this could have happened. Like, without the institutional knowledge of those small towns and rural places, like High Country had to cover the Bundys, do you think that all the coverage now that's being focused on those places can be true?
Well, I think, you know, the country is like this huge centrifuge, and the elite, I guess, is what the Trump people would call them, have centrifuged out to the coasts and a few spots in between, leaving the rest of the country kind of depopulated of, we don't, even in Delta County, I mean, we've clumped together in Paonia, one of which, whose precincts narrowly voted for Secretary Clinton. But the other 19 precincts in Delta County voted overwhelmingly for President Trump, who got 69.5% of the vote here. So, I mean, in a way, the media reflects the country. They've clumped, the national media have clumped on the coasts and certain urban centers. And so they don't understand America. I mentioned that I'd heard a talk by the top editor at the New York Times, a man named Dean Baquette, right, a few months after the election. And he said the election taught us that the New York Times doesn't understand America, which I thought was a wonderful thing to say, wonderfully honest thing to say. But I don't know how, you almost have to fix the country. You have to get, we're just not living together anymore. I mean, I'm in over my head here.
I think everybody is. Since you published the paper, how have the biggest stories of the West changed?
I sort of have shut down. It's, for me, the West ended in 2002. I mean, as a region, I used to think I knew the million square mile region. Hell, I don't know who the head of the Forest Service is anymore, or the head of the BLM. I barely know who the Interior Secretary is. So those were things I knew. I knew all the professors who were writing about all this stuff and thinking about it, like Charles Wilkinson and Patty Limerick. But I don't anymore. So I'm in a way, I left in 02. In 4 years, I'll be like Rip Van Winkle.
And I guess then, if you haven't paid attention, since 2002, what were the biggest stories in 83 and how did they change by 2002?
Well, in 83, it was James Watt, wall-to-wall James Watt. And he was Ryan Zinke and Donald Trump and Scott Pruitt all rolled together. And he was a Wyomingite. He wore a big hat. And as far as he was concerned, the only trouble with the West was that it had 500,000 square miles of public land, and he wanted to do everything to make it private. And there was a Sagebrush Rebellion. The West was in a deep depression because oil, we'd had an energy boom, and that Carter had set off, President Carter, and that energy boom collapsed in 82. And it was an oil shale. They were going to build coal-fired power plants everywhere, transmission lines everywhere, oil shale. Exxon was going to its colony project in western Colorado. It was going to build these enormous pits, 600, a mile wide and hundreds of feet thick, mile long and hundreds of feet thick. And they were going to take the shale off the front of the pit, dump it in, take out the rock, dump the waste in the back, and these pits were to roll across the landscape. And meanwhile, because there's no water out here, they were going to divert the Missouri River into Colorado. The scale of the imagining on fossil fuels, I mean, now it's sort of nothing. But that's what was going on, and people were out here like flies on horse manure, and from all over, it was so exciting. Booms are always exciting. Busts are less exciting. I mean, when this town went bust, one out of every two houses was empty in the mid-80s. And people just left. And so that's what was going on then. And High Country News we were sort of this lone outpost. The town was, stores were board, not boarded up, but vacant. And here we are, we're sort of thriving in a modest way because our income came from outside. Our reader, I didn't have any readers in Paonia, which was great compared to North Fork Times because I wasn't going to meet anyone on the street who was mad at me. So that was 83 when, you know, in 02, this was a thriving place. It began to come back in the early 90s. And so did the West. And that's when the real estate, it came back as a real estate play, not a natural resource play. Really, the last natural resource play that the West saw was in the early 80s with oil, shale, and coal, and so on. I mean, they were going to dam the Colorado at Dominguez Canyon. There were all sorts of exciting things that were going to happen. And Amory Lovins, who's, you know, the energy guru, who's a genius, came to Delta High School and spoke in the auditorium one night during this period, one evening. And he said, look, he said, 90% of this stuff isn't going to happen. It doesn't pencil out. I mean, he had a vision. He could see. And he was right. And just like now, just like, you know, listen, stock market is going boom, 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 boom. The balloon gets blown up and the balloon loses air, either with a hiss or a bang. And this boom we're having here will end too, and I don't know how.
So that the boom and bust cycle and similar administrations and interior secretaries was one of the big stories. Were there other stories that really come to the front of your mind when thinking?
Well, there was, you know, the continuing fight over cattle, over logging. Okay, so the Forest Service was logging 12 billion board feet a year, much of it out of the Pacific Northwest. I mean, they were destroying the old growth spotted owl forests up there. And that ended. And now they're down to something like 2 or 3 billion board feet a year. And they're just firefighters. So that was, and dams were on the drawing boards, and they've all gone. No one's going to build a dam. The story shifted from dam building to taking out dams. And a guy took over the Bureau of Reclamation, and I ought to remember his name, and he was all about reforming the Bureau, turning it from a construction outfit into a maintenance and deconstruction outfit. We published High Country News in a period where the pendulum swung. Natural resource development no longer ran the West. And I thought that was all great. What I didn't foresee was that it would become real, you know, the land would become a real estate play. You know, one of the best things about being here is that it's a blue-collar culture. Or it was a blue-collar culture, working people. And they built this town. And a different kind of person is inheriting it. When I moved here, there were 5 hardware stores on this street. The Blue Sage was a beautiful hardware store. He would, if your the grates on your wood stove burned out, you know, wore out, he could find the guy or the little company that had the molds for that grate, and he'd have it cast and sent, and you could replace your grates. Because your wood-burning stove, of course, was the heart of your house. Or if the arsenic sprayer, backpack sprayer that you used to combat the coddling moths broke a spring, you know, he'd find that spring in one of these many drawers. That place, was the Blue Sage Gallery, was lined by these wonderful old hardwood cabinets with drawers, and they all had things in them. You didn't order it and get it next day by FedEx. He had to stock it. And he had maybe a 10-foot-wide, this is Shorty Hunting, Howard's Cash Hardware, maybe a 10-foot-wide line of bound paper catalogs, like the old Sears catalogs, but they were parts catalogs. And whatever you wanted, he could get it for you.
What did Paonia look like when you and Betsy got here?
Looked like it does today. Hasn't changed. You know, the downtown. There's a few more houses. And something you wouldn't notice just walking around, the houses now have foundations under them. Whereas most of the houses were just built on river rock. So the newcomers came and they put foundations under there, dug them out and put foundations under the house. But what the old timers notice is they don't take good care of the yards. They're critical of, and I don't pay attention, but they think we aren't very good at growing flowers and stuff. When I came here, every morning I'd go for coffee in the diner. I mean, it's right where the diner is now. And there were always 10 or 12 guys who were sitting around complaining about the state of the world. And I said, you know, when I get to be old, I'm going to try not to do that. So I try.
And I guess, is there anything that I didn't ask you about that I should have asked you about?
No, you asked me about more things than you should have, probably. But I would just say, you know, there's a biblical saying that goes roughly like, without vision, the people shall perish. And if you don't have vision, you either need to get it or get out. And so when I lost my vision, as I said, I got out. But it took more time than it should have.
You've been listening to an interview with longtime Paonia resident and former High Country News publisher Ed Marston, who passed away on August 31st. We will miss you, Ed. This is Allie Lightfoot for KVNF.